Lord.
This is Thursday.
Thursday, April 18th, 2024.
That's right. 3 days after the 112th anniversary
Lincoln's assassination.
Dang.
Yeah, he actually lived another 70 years and was killed.
I was right on the day. I was off on the year.
You're talking the Titanic sinking?
Yeah, very good. Titanic sinking. Yep.
So the Titanic struck on the 14th.
Yep.
And my sister's birthday is April 14th. So it was the night the Titanic struck the iceberg, the night Abraham Lincoln was shot, and that year she was born, it happened to be Good Friday. So we give her a hard time.
Which is when the 14th was, when Lincoln was killed. That was really Good Friday, wasn't it, Landon?
I don't know.
He died on the 15th.
Oh, was shot on the
14th. Yeah, but he would have been, I'm sure he was probably shot before midnight.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Somehow, yeah. Like, they didn't pronounce him dead for, like, several hours. Oh, guys, so I finally, have you ever read to the end? Have you ever read to the end of Team of Rivals?
No, I've never read it.
I got to the end. I'm like 20 pages left. Pretty much all of the best quotes in the Lincoln movie are actual Lincoln documented quotes.
That's cool.
Which,
really?
I thought that was more theatrical. But no, they're real quotes. It's pretty. I thought that was really cool.
I like that.
Father Abraham.
So it was English he spoke, not Aramaic. Okay, so I'm the first speech guy to get canceled.
You are?
What? What happened? You get kicked off of Facebook for the odds were
you'd definitely be fourth. Like, all three of us would probably have been canceled before you.
Yeah, I was gonna say, I'm almost ashamed it wasn't me.
I actually rip off my shirt, it's a Trump shirt. I've been testing you all. No, so you remember that writers conference that I went to
in Kansas
City a month and a half or 2 months ago. Okay, so I don't remember if I mentioned, but when I was there, one of the most useful interactions I had there was with a woman named who she started a I'll leave names out so I can leave this in here. But she started a writing group, and, you know, it's just about putting other aspiring amateur writers together to talk about your work, and then each small group is sort of led or facilitated by someone who's on staff with this writing group company. And so they give you, like, a free trial, which basically plays out to one free group meeting of collaboration, right? So it's basically sort of how you intuit it. You submit basically one chapter of your work, and then they all submit comparable volume, and then you look at it, you make comments, blah blah. So I did this, and I thought it was fairly constructive. This group has other sort of platforms or ways you can interact with the staff in order to improve your writing. I was looking at a couple of other things, but I decided that paying for this monthly subscription for this group was worthwhile, and I wanted to do it. So I decided all this through back and forth emails with this woman whom I had met at the conference, who was also like the group leader for that one meeting. And she said, "Oh, yep, this is great. Yep, I'm gonna put you with that same group that you met with a few weeks ago." And he's like, "Sure, that sounds good. That's fine." And 12 hours later, so this all happened this past weekend, and I upload my work, and I see my other group member stuff, and I was like, oh, okay, I'm gonna try to pick away at it a little bit at work and make sure I get home with enough time to look at, make legitimate comments. So next day at work, I try logging into this group's content, and it says, you're not a part of a group. I'm like, what the heck? Oh, gosh. Now I'm doing this all on my phone, and I'm just thinking, like, there's just some login issue. So I delete my cache and try accessing, still nothing. Try my other phone, still nothing. And I'm thinking, like, oh, gosh, it's just something with my browser. Yeah. So I just got to get home and pull it up on my desktop. And I get home, and it still says, you're not a part of a group. I'm like, okay. So by now, it's like 25 minutes until my group's meeting. And I call up the website administrator, tech guy. And I'm like, hey. And he says, hello. And now I talked to this guy once before, and he said, oh, hey, Mike, because, you know, they know it's you. Hello. And I was like, oh, hey, just trying to get access to my group's content. I'm meeting in 20 minutes. And he says, we decided you weren't a good fit for... I'll tell you the name of the group here, but I'll bleep it out. And I was like, huh? And he's like, did you get your refund? And I said, what? No, I'm confused. I just purchased a subscription, a membership. Like, and he's like, yes, the staff, everyone agreed that you weren't a good fit based upon some violent comments that you made and breaking our community code of conduct several times. Oh my gosh. So I was so befuddled. Like, what in the heck could they be talking about?
Oh, no.
And I basically came up with two working theories, one of which...
Theories you don't know for sure?
No, not at all.
Oh, wow.
Because my only interactions was this group and one email of someone else. Like, I knew that the woman I was working with had to have been okay with me because, like, there's no way after talking for 4 weeks she'd be like, no,
yeah,
we don't
want
you. So there's nothing interacting with her. It was either my group, my two group members, or this one other woman, which I don't see how that could be the case because, again, that was, like, a month ago. And, and mind you also that, like, once I got this group, 12 hours later, I was kicked out.
It's a subgroup of the conference, not the entire conference itself.
Okay. Yeah, just like this. Yeah, exactly. Two other people. And, like, reasonable theory is that they were offended by my criticisms, which I gave them some positive. And, like, I felt like I was... I feel like you guys know how my criticism goes. It's just like, yeah, this is sort of what I saw, blah, blah, blah. But yeah, that's my other hypothesis was that they figured out about like the speech guys and Biking for Babies and they didn't want to be associated with that. But that I don't think you can get that easily just by Googling Mike Schaefer. So, but the specific things. Because they did have a sort of a hard time grabbing hold of, like, you could say, like, the stakes for Mel and Grady. And I did do a brief, like, proselytizing is not quite the right word. But just, I don't know if you remember that paragraph where it's like, running was dangerous to Mel. She felt, you know, so much of the world was sterile and safe with drive-thrus and air conditioning and standardized testing. I sort of spoke that paragraph to some extent, sort of like explain the stakes. And I don't know if maybe like saying that the world is too safe of a place was maybe specifically what triggered my group member.
That's weird. Yeah. I did try Googling Michael Schaefer. There's enough Michael Schaefers out there, it would be hard to find Biking for Babies or Speech Guys based off of that. Yeah. If that's all they had access to was your name. And not more details about you. But
do you go? Anyway. Yeah. It was probably just a nature of super build up criticism they wanted. And you probably just came across as a bit too straightforward.
I guess. Yeah.
I'm kind of jealous too. I'm kind of on Matt's team.
Millennials.
I
want
to get canceled.
What? Oh, you're jealous? Yeah. I see.
All right, let's say some crazy stuff tonight, guys.
All right, let's do it.
Shall we jump in?
When you see the road, Michael Schaefer, Ross Johnson, Matt Schultz and Landon Fry are all here this evening.
Free.
I'm just gonna say it. I've been thinking it for 10 minutes. I don't want a podcast here.
Oh yeah. Now
I've seen the road. Pregnancy is a beautiful thing. Pregnancy is a gift. There
are stories to tell.
Paint sticks to asteroids.
If you don't climb your walls. Afraid some days, but the road will
lead us to a better place. We are called to emerge from that default setting of self-involvement.
You ready?
Doing my homework. Are we calling Rachel?
She said that a tornado blew her house away or something like that.
Let's jump in.
Okay, it's episode like 1,000 or something like that, the speech guys, but also significantly...
5346.
Also significantly, it is the last speech guys episode within...
Here's to Q1. Q1 24, wrapping up.
Within the, Q1 24. Yeah, Landon's good with that catchy branding there. So, Landon, what do we got tonight?
Well, as batting, I haven't watched baseball. What's the fourth batter called?
Clean up.
I always choose the oldest / the greatest of the oldest. So we're rewinding the clocks back to 1941. A Oscar nominated, it did not win Best Picture in 1941, but over the decades, it's redeemed itself. And by any list you would ever look up, it is the number one movie of all time, Citizen Kane.
Sounds like a great film, Landon.
It's okay. I mean, it's okay.
As long as there's... Oh, never mind. I won't believe that. Well, we're not...
So it's a speech from the main character, who is also the director, writer, producer, and lead actor. So we got the speech. We got the context of this greatest movie ever. We've got this early 20th century scenery. Shall we listen to the speech?
Writer, producer, director, star. He sounds like the first Robert Redford before Robert Redford.
Right. Such a great man would have to have humble roots in Illinois. And he does.
Naturally.
And he does.
Well, we ain't the movie guys. We're the speech guys. Why don't we take a listen to the speech that's going to sort of anchor and tether our Orson Welles Citizen Kane vision here. Landon, why don't you set up the context for this speech?
The campaigner. There's only one who can rule the politics of this state.
Context, Landon. Where does this show up?
This speech is right up the top of the middle of the movie. Mr. Kane,
Citizen Kane.
Sorry
to interrupt
Kane.
You again. I'm not doing this to be silly, but just thinking out loud here. While not many people have seen Citizen Kane, none of us had up until this podcast.
How many? What would you say? 1%? 2%?
I've seen it. I saw it once before.
It's definitely 1%
or
less.
Wow, that low?
1%
of people have seen Citizen Kane. I feel like it's anyone who took a film class in college has seen it.
It's even less than 1%.
I don't know.
Did you go to I feel like a lot of people take film classes. They hate you.
I would say it's the same number of people who have seen 2001 A Space Odyssey, which I also put at 1%.
Yeah, I'd say maybe 7.
I was going to say, anyway.
What is the story of Citizen Kane in which the speech emerges? What's the broad story?
Yes. The broader story is a media mogul. Some call him like Logan Roy plus, I don't have the list in front of me, but Logan Roy, Howard Hughes, what are some more modern takes? I should have had a list of names here. Logan Roy is the lead actor in Succession. Media mogul, business mogul, plus an attempted political mogul. Kind of like another version of a Great Gatsby could be a way to talk about it. Rupert Murdoch is the name that I was searching for, the owner of the media conglomerate in New York City that would include the Fox and Wall Street Journal publications. So he's that plus kind of a Andrew Carnegie business tycoon, a lot of resorts, hotels, etc. But it's his life story. It starts at the end. So it's perhaps the first movie where it begins at the ending scene and then has a little bit of mystery and then walks back to the first scene. I mean, this is one of the first movies where we ever had sound. So much of watching it, you're like, you know, this is probably the first time most every element has been done before. But unless you're like a film critic about it, you're like, that's boring because it all looks old. But, you know, one aspect was towards the end, they were walking through and they're like, you know, talking as they go throughout this web of scenery. It's like, oh, that's Aaron Sorkin-y. But it's not Aaron Sorkin-y, it's Citizen Kane-y. And it hinges on the question of a mystery. We're seen in the very beginning of a story, a sled with the word Rosebud on it. And to just give away the spoilers, that's how it ends. The sled is burned at the end scene. And right after the first scene, basically the first lieutenant, I call him, of this Kane Empire is like, well, here's his last word. It was Rosebud. He uttered Rosebud on his deathbed. What the heck does that mean? We need to write a story. We need to memorialize him in our next movie, our next paper, our next magazine. Somebody needs to get to the bottom of who is the real Mr. Citizen Kane, Charles Kane, and given this last word, like, what's the backstory here? So the entire movie is a search for that question.
Okay. And the speech emerges where in that story?
This speech right at the top. I would say he's got money. He got money from his mother, owned a bunch of land that a silver or gold mine was on. So even by the time he was like 18, he's got like this enormous trust fund of which he then starts buying up papers, media assets, just imposing his will and worldview on the nation. And as he's reaching up towards the pinnacle, he decides to start running for office and to exchange money for power. This particular scene is for the governor of New York. And it's his campaign speech. It's like the one political scene right in the middle. A downfall, a scandal comes just after this scene and kind of starts to unravel. But this is the peak, and here's what he says.
There is only one man who can rid the politics of this state of the evil domination of Boss Jim Geddes.
Right.
I am speaking of Charles Foster Kane. the fighting liberal, the friend of the working man, the next governor of this state, who entered upon this campaign with one purpose only, to point out and make public the dishonesty, the downright villainy of boss Jim W. Getty's political machine, now in complete control of the government of this state. I made no campaign promises, because until a few weeks ago, I had no hope of being elected. Now, however, I have something more than a hope. Jim Geddes has something less than a chance. Every straw vote, every independent poll shows that I'll be elected. The working man, and the slum child know they can expect my best efforts in their interests. The decent, ordinary citizens know that I'll do everything in my power to protect the underprivileged, the underpaid, and the underfed.
Mother, is Pop governor yet?
Not yet, Junior.
Well, I'd make my promises now if I weren't too busy arranging to keep them. Here's one promise I'll make, and boss Jim Geddes knows I'll keep it. My first official act as governor of this state will be to appoint a special district attorney to arrange for the indictment, prosecution, and conviction of boss Jim W. Geddes!
I think I was the first one to watch it, other than Matt at NYU. I knew it was considered one of the best, or the best, either that or Dark Knight, you know, if you're looking at IMDb's list. so.
Really? I didn't realize that.
Or AFI, or one of those two. Put one of these two at the top, depending upon their mood. But, okay. So I definitely had interest in watching it. I think later on, maybe I'll come up with a discussion. Landon asked if we'd like old movies. I put forth some effort, certainly appreciate some culture. So all those things being said, I certainly had a receptive disposition to Citizen Kane's story. First reactions to his story, the speech, the movie. Well, maybe I'll just sort of loop in some of the old movie question here. I mean, what I appreciate about old films, and this film being one of those, is just the dialogue. The dialogue is so good. The dialogue is speaking into layers of human experience versus modern movies. Dialogue was written by, like, some intern who's just, you know, a junior NYU. Yeah, because dialogue is all they have. They don't have CGI or whatnot. I had texted the crew here in the middle of watching this several things, something like, wow, or holy smokes. And
that's all I texted. I didn't know if he was like, this is dumb, this is great. He left us hanging, so I'm really curious. What was behind those words?
It was something that it was the effect of, like, wow, this is Donald Trump's story. And I thought that Landon had picked this as, like, some sort of ode to Donald Trump. Like, I'm not even exaggerating. That's, like, the similarities were so uncanny. You know, we'll touch on some of them later, but, like, the two versions of the newspaper after his election, one saying, you know, Citizen Kane wins, and the other one saying, election fraud, right? Fraud at yeah, them. And the yeah. speech itself, too, you know, rather than speaking in terms of specific policy differences between him and this Geddes gentleman, it's, no, he should be in prison. That's just very mature language. And then looking out for the common end, the end, like, I'm protecting you. I'm protecting you from Jim Geddes. That's what I'm doing. It just sounded very, very familiar. Overall, yeah, really enjoyed the movie. Very interesting. Definitely got me thinking about the archetype, which we'll talk about later, but I'll save as a placeholder for now. But
all right, we'll pin archetype at the top of the to-do list here. First takes from the other two.
I was pretty excited when you picked the movie. So we have, me and Julie have been trying over the winter just to try to kind of watch more classic movies, I guess. So I think this was the fifth, like, pretty oldie, quote-unquote, movie that we've watched. And when we were looking at the other ones, like Citizen Kane, obviously it pops up right when you Google, right, best movie ever. But we just hadn't picked that one yet for kind of, we had some reasons we wanted to watch the other ones too. So I was kind of excited because it kind of gave me an excuse to watch this one. And as far as, I don't know, like the question of appreciation of old movies, I don't feel like I had seen very many, to be totally honest, other than It's a Wonderful Life. But again, over this last winter, I guess if you count the five now, I've seen six old movies. But I agree with Mike. Like, it's just kind of interesting, the dialogue and like how you follow the movie seems different, just because how much of it seems to be centered on or the dialogue being so important. So anyway, I was excited when you picked it. Speech itself, yeah, I think similar. Like, kind of laughed a little bit. The Trump comparison did jump out a little bit even before we started the outline going. Movie was really good. I'll be totally honest, just putting it out there, when it first got over, I think my initial reaction was, man, that was good, but I don't see that being the best movie ever. I do feel like it stuck with me though for a couple days. Like, I kind of kept thinking about it in different parts of it and stuff like that. So
more than Inside Llewyn Davis.
It didn't make me feel sick inside. so just better. But no, I mean, I guess, I don't know, maybe that's the mark of a good movie, is right, because that's kind of my complaint about like the Marvel movies, is like they're super entertaining while you're watching them, and then you click the movie off and it's like you just completely forgot, or not forgot, but just it's completely done, you know, it just doesn't stick with you. But yeah, so I mean, this definitely stuck with me for a couple days after, just kind of thinking about different parts and how it tied together, and oh yeah, like that comment early on, like, yeah, that actually might have been some foreshadowing that I missed a little bit, and things like that. So yeah, so after giving it a couple days to chew on, I'd be willing to be debated, I guess, on hearing better arguments for if it's the best movie ever. But
I think his desire to protect the underprivileged and, you know, all that does speak to his character, that's the stance he took. You know what I mean? Because the stance didn't, in the grand scheme of the story, you could have written a similar story with maybe a different stance, but I feel like maybe you couldn't have. I don't know. Just with his like childhood and stuff, I could see that maybe resonating well with him. But in regard to the movie, so I never grew up watching a ton of black and white films. I just had a hard time with them as a younger man. But they're starting to grow on me a little bit more. I know Claire grew up watching a lot of them. There are a few that she's shown me that that I thought were really good. Talk of the Town is one of them. I think that's the name of it. There's a really funny black and white movie called The Thin Man. I think there's two or three versions or sequels or whatever of that movie. But very good, kind of a comedy whodunit type of thing. But yeah, I mean, a few things. Just with the film in general, as Mike said, in my time at NYU, I did take a film class, as all NYU students do. But yeah, it did remind me, because there are a handful of things that I did remember and notice this time, just like you know, the scene where he's basically about to get into this, you know, the scandal trap thing. You know, they film it almost through the railings, you know, almost looks like prison bars or something. It's a very iconic scene where they kind of go through, the camera goes through the sign, down through the glass roof into this kind of like nightclub scene. And, you know, I imagine that was probably the first time they did that, but that shot has been recreated so many times, you know. The camera slowly kind of zooming in through glass or something. Just a handful of things like that that were just like, wow, that was a really not like an overt in your face commentary, but things that just added a lot to the film.
Yeah.
You don't get as much of when you have CGI and a lot of other things at your disposal.
Yeah. Rounding out first takes. It was a Trumpian speech. And it is interesting. You can look at it. Maybe we'll put it in our show notes. Trump's a huge fan of Citizen Kane and has a whole video on breaking down a 4-minute movie critical analysis of it.
Of him doing that analysis?
He analyzed the movie and talked about its characteristics. Man. Yeah. So you do wonder if life is following art a little bit there. This speech really comes straight off the 2016 stump campaign that he ran. I think I didn't choose it because of that. I just think it was interesting parallels, and we should look at the movie and the speech because it rounds out this quad nicely. So he's a fan. We'll get to archetype. I think a couple aspects at the beginning of the movie, the headlines that were ran in the papers post-election, kind of the media mogul stuff, you do kind of, yeah, compare to Trump a little bit. But then it splits off and maybe it becomes a more of a general archetype. It is... you know, the lonely rich man is the archetype. I think the fact that, like, The Great Gatsby was written in the 20s and this was written after that, this is kind of just a little bit of another version of that. It was the writer called Mank, which a movie starring Gary... the guy who played the cop in The Dark Knight, Gary Oldman... stars in it. So the writer alongside Orson Welles, who wrote, directed, starred, edited, produced, they both wrote this, and it was roughly based off of William Randolph Hearst, which was the West Coast media mogul of the 20s and 30s. Just a couple quick factual things. He, like, when he heard this movie was kind of based off of him, he hadn't even watched it yet, and he, like, tried to shut it down. He, like, threatened movie theaters to even show it. And so it didn't have, like, it didn't return its box office numbers. It didn't win the Best Picture Award. It was nominated. And a little bit like It's a Wonderful Life, it didn't really, like, pop up in, like, the vernacular and get its true time in the spotlight until a few decades later, because it was a bit suppressed because he thought it was a bad portrayal of himself. Yeah, a couple factuals. I think moving into archetype would be interesting. Fun fact on William Randolph Hearst. Does anybody, I think I've mentioned this before on air or off. What's the really cool thing about William Randolph Hearst? A la Illinois.
Oh, he's from Woodstock, right? Is he from Woodstock? Is that the...
No, that was Orson Welles who starred. Orson Welles grew up in Chicago. Then he mostly lived in Ogle County, where we camped 2 springs ago, right down the road from John Deere. Then he went to Woodstock. William Randolph Hearst, huge, the Donald Trump of the 1920s. Who Citizen Kane portrays, wrote the check. He bought New Salem in 1906, wrote the check, bought it, got it like locked up, and then he immediately turned around and gave it to the local Chautauqua. And Chautauquas were like summer gatherings of collegial seminars, speeches, historical readings. He just gifted it back to him, but he got the money, gobbled up the land, turned it over to the best performing educational nonprofit. And when you walk up to New Salem, there's a stone there and there's a plaque on it that says William Randolph Hearst is kind of the reason we were able to preserve this from. And so who knows how he, somebody wrote him a letter and got him to send some money to like get New Salem locked down as a historic site. But fun fact, side fact.
Sounds like a generous gift.
All right. So the best movie ever. Best movie ever. An American mogul. What is it about this archetype that either requires it to be the best movie ever or is such a good archetype it deserves it to be at the forefront of our literature or mythology?
I mean, I think it's a very, I mean, it's a super old archetype. I mean, I'm reminded of like an Icarus type of tale, you know, flying too close to the sun, you know, getting too big for your britches, whatever. I mean, I think just the age of it. It's also a popular archetype since most people aren't the super rich person. So I feel like it's one that everyone can be like, oh yeah, see how bad that is, you know? So it's not one that like, I mean, I think if you think about it, you could apply a lot of what a lot of his struggles to our lives, just in kind of smaller or different degrees. You know, obviously none of us are throwing money around like he is, but I think some of the themes in terms of, you know, he had this money to give that didn't mean much to him because he had so much. He was willing to give that up, but he wouldn't give up things like, you know, his heart, his, you know, being vulnerable. So, yeah, I mean, I think it's one that you can learn from, you could teach, but it isn't like a super threatening one either for the average person.
I think something kind of similar, or not similar, but yeah, I guess similar and kind of interesting about kind of the rich, you know, newspaper baron kind of dabbled in politics, whatever it may be. Like, I feel like in some ways, I won't say that that's like what the American dream is trying to put out that we should be like. But I think a lot, not a lot, some of the attributes or like some of the ideas I think we do with the quote unquote American dream kind of push people towards that. You know, we want to achieve success, be a good leader, do well financially. Like, I don't know. I just feel like kind of he is in some ways, I feel like we're kind of pushed towards, you know, go to college, get a degree, be successful, make a lot of money, those type of things. I think that he's kind of the epitome of, I guess, you know, he had all of them. So I think it's interesting, like we kind of, even like, I feel like our society kind of pushes people towards that at the same time, recognizing that that's like not it's not going to make you happy, but yet we still haven't really stopped pushing people towards that. So I don't know, are you guys on the archetypal thing or this idea of this kind of the rich businessman? And I kind of feel like it's with, I don't know, like Matt said, it's kind of easy because, right, most of us aren't super rich. But I kind of feel like there's this kind of dynamic of like, we all want to be that person. I mean, yeah, I guess I'll just say like most people want to be that person at the same time recognizing like that person is not happy. Yep.
Maybe one little detail to spell out a little bit more clearly from what Ross said there. Yeah, the idea of what are the attractive elements of the Randolph Hearst, Trump, Kane archetype right here. It's a certain aspect of the American dream, rags to riches. But then the other aspect of it is then putting yourself in position in order to bring the other rags up to riches, right? And that's what Citizen Kane does, genuine or not genuine, up for debate. You know, that's what, at least how Trump presents himself, genuine or not genuine, you know, up for debate in a sense. But yeah, that's it. Yeah, so it's like the American dream. It's like new Coke. It's like new American. This is the improved American dream. Like that, I think that's a certain aspect.
It's like America's great again type of dream.
Yeah. Yeah.
Did were there, and I'm asking this genuinely. I watched the movie once. I didn't like rewatch it. Call it like the first 30 minutes. He's like building the newspaper. He kind of like turned the money matters over, and he wanted to like buy the journalists. And, you know, he's like, oh, we're going to go get those best ones. And like flash forward to like 6 years later, he got them all. And there was a sort of magnanimity. About him that it didn't seem like overly, I don't know, I guess it was self-serving, but it was compelling. Yeah.
Well, was it not? I'm confused, or what's magnanimous about hiring the best journalist for your newspaper?
I don't know. He was dreaming big. He's like, we're going to, you know, we're going to be them. Like, we're going to be so good. We're going to attract that talent. And then it was like in 6 years, which in today's timeline, if you don't accomplish that in 6 months, yeah, like you're a failure. I thought it was kind of funny. Like he was able to like do this over 6 years. It seemed like a different scale of like accomplishing success.
I sort of see where you're coming from being magnanimous rather than just putting these other newspapers out of, you know, print or whatever. I mean, I saw it as, well, look, in order to look, my core values as Citizen Kane are to, you know, like I like how you said it. You said it really succinctly, right? The start landing trading. I've got all the money in the world. Now it's about trading money for power, and or at least a certain amount of it. And so, therefore, what I recognize in America is that journalism has the power. So therefore, I have to control journalism, and hiring these best writers was the first step in that.
Yeah, and I guess what I'm trying to say is the first thing I watched with this movie was the speech that we're talking about. And I'm like, oh, man, that looks like old Donnie Trump. And then, like, watching the movie, separating myself from that take or that perspective, especially in the first leading up until that, he didn't seem, I don't know, like a bad guy. He seemed like a guy, I don't know, make a stamp on the world or his industry, or, you know, just piece together some success, even though he was already rich. He wasn't overly hoardous or like,
at that point, he didn't seem to see his wealth as like the ends. He said, seemed to see it as a means, which is kind of how you should see your wealth. Obviously, like, you'd want to use that to a good means, to whatever degree that's truly what was going on in his heart. You know, that's part of the, I think the mystery of the film is like, you don't really know what's going on in someone's heart, but, it seemed much more authentic then. And I think at least plausible that he was truly trying to look out for the common man and hire reporters that would give the common man like a greater voice, you know? So I guess to me, that does seem like a magnanimous type of thing. Like, you know, this bold move, thinking big, trying to stick to the values that he wrote on the first newspaper, you know? And yeah, it wasn't until later on that those values got skewed and those values got basically trampled over. and, you know, eventually literally torn up, you know, by him.
So on the, if we're thinking of like archetype, he went after, like, his marriage fell apart. He went after other women. That, the fact that he had a scandal kind of brought him down right after this speech. He was confronted that he's having an affair, that affair would be publicized. I don't think he won the election. And everything kind of tumbles. How would we apply that to an archetype or?
I don't know if we necessarily have to. I mean, there's just certain attributes of the character. Yeah,
just because... what it was. Yeah. I did hear. I was looking for I kind of think even if a story was written in the 1940s, like, it's playing off of some other prior story. Mm-hmm. And the best comparison I saw was like, this is a little bit of like an American Solomon, like,
sure.
Like, you know, perhaps some amount of wisdom or a ton of riches and the ability to, you know, use proverbial wisdom influence over others, and kind of it was just fallen down by a lust for women in power, and then it ends up in like a pretty big loneliness that is exemplified in parts of Ecclesiastes or Proverbs, of kind of a warning trap. And then when I this is not my take, I just scouring, you know, the infinite internet, it's like, oh, that, this does seem like a Solomon story that fits pretty well.
I had not really thought about the Solomon take, to be totally honest. I kind of see it. I kind of buy that when you talk about it, especially with the women and the riches corrupting. Like, somebody that had power in the first place probably had very good intentions and then was corrupted by women and riches. So I definitely, I guess, to hit home on the archetype point, like, I definitely see that being an issue. I don't know exactly where to take that other than just kind of another example of the same, if that makes sense, you know. He kind of seemed authentic originally. And I kind of had that. I think Mike might have said something, you know, this might have been an opportunity to buy power with the newspaper. At least watching the movie, seeing it once, I definitely took him to be a little more authentic in his younger years, and that he thought he was, you know, doing a good thing with the money that he had, however immature he was with it, because he was 25, you know. But I definitely took him out to be authentic originally, and then, yeah, kind of corrupted by kind of just getting sucked more and more into it, you know, just slowly, and couldn't really get out of that trap. I feel like it might be a good time to kind of, unless you guys disagree, kind of branch, you know, why he was unable to, as he was, you know, so he's getting kind of sucked into this trap of more power, more money, women or woman, you know, this one girl, like, you know, the breakfast table scene with his wife was kind of powerful, you know, just how it kind of eroded over time and how they were able to show that in such a short amount of time. But
can we recount the breakfast scene?
I'll just do it. So Kane here, you know, he's doing really well. He has bought the newspaper. He's becoming more and more powerful. He's got all the money he can have. He goes on a trip, and he ends up coming back to New York and marrying the president's niece, I believe. So kind of, you might say, getting pulled more and more into starting the path into the political side of things, just the fact that the president is mentioned. And so, you know, they get married, they're very happy, they're young, and then the movie shows, I think they might have come back. I mean, did it start with, they came back after a night, were they like out partying for an evening or something, and they come back and it shows them at the breakfast table or something like that, and then it just keeps showing them at the breakfast table, and you can just see how they look. It's not even just the words they're saying. It, you know, comes from very playful and attracted to each other to very bitter, you know, and withdrawn, but it kind of does it progressively over. It's got, you know, maybe 10 takes of them sitting at the breakfast table, and it just shows a 10 to 20 second conversation. Maybe even not that, but
table gets further and further apart. Like the seats, their seats away from each other are more and more distant. And I think in the end, they're just sitting on the far ends of the table reading separate newspapers. Yeah. You know,
they point that out at NOAU, Matt, yeah. That table distance.
Actually, Mike's boy, Donald, Mike's boy.
It was the panning. It was the way the camera zoomed out.
But, that's funny. Yeah. So to kind of get back to the point then, I feel like it's worth looking at, you know, so if this archetype exists, you know, it's obviously a real thing, but I think the movie where it was interesting and we can, you know, tie it in toward the ending scene more and more is like why he got drawn into it though. So not just this kind of distant archetype guy, but like why did, you know, Charles Foster Kane get sucked into this so much and why was he unable to, I don't want to say fight it off, why was he unable to get out of the trap, if that makes sense? Yeah. I
feel escape like that's an the interesting whirlpool point. Of
it's like I'm trying to distill Orson Welles' lesson out, like what's the archetypal lesson, if you will, of this character and his compadres throughout history. And I might say it would be this. It is that power is a poor substitute for virtue, or inadequate substitute. And what I mean by that is that, you know, you begin, his character begins with, you know, let's just say genuine for the sake of argument, to get into politics and culture by running this newspaper that's principled, and getting this Jim Getty guy out, who apparently is not for the people and serving the people. Okay, so that's his core moral calculus, which seems good on the surface. And then he goes about trying to achieve those things through, you know, lying in the news, right? Having two different versions of the newspaper. And then at the same time, like, not taking seriously these other things going on in this life, right? Having this affair and then clearly having a fixation on collecting things, just material things that we see in his massive empty house. And so you see that doesn't work. What you don't see in the film is the opposite of that, if you will. Someone who, you know, obviously not every journey to political influence is like not necessarily immoral, but there are certain power calculuses to make. Otherwise, Jesus would have been president of the world if it was just purely moral, right? Certain power calculuses aren't bad, but not at the disservice of virtue. And so it's like, so who's the opposite of then of the Citizen Kane? It's, you know, obviously no politician is perfect, but, you know, someone like your Ronald Reagan, presumably, right? Who was very wise or prudent politically, but also seemingly did not compromise himself quite as morally. That's the way to achieve that sort of legacy of service.
Putting old Ronnie on the pedestal.
I thought you were gonna say Abe Lincoln.
But I think so I watched it with Claire, and she didn't. Claire did not like the movie. Initially, I think it grew on her part because, like, you meant like your experience, Ross, like, really, it's like, oh, that was it. That's like the greatest movie of all time. But it does stick with you. You do think about it for a few days afterward. And Claire and I have talked about it a couple times since.
What were you thinking about? What were a couple of the things that you thought about?
I'm going to get there, I guess. Yeah, I'm going to get there. But Claire's...
Hold your horses, Landon!
Claire's initial response...
Were you thinking, I hope Claire kisses me during the movie?
She was hoping for like a sign of hope, some sort of like silver lining or some sort of like resolution to the film, which obviously it doesn't give you. It's almost very, you know, exactly the opposite.
Shakespeare wrote tragedies.
Yeah. So it's, yeah. So I think that was part of her frustration with the film. It just seemed to kind of wallow. But at the same time, she did make the, she, like her quote was, and this is a I think a pretty exact quote from Claire. She can yell at me if she wants.
A Claire quote.
But as a mom, I just thought throughout the movie, will somebody help him? You know, and like you mentioned, Ross, like why did he get stuck? Like why couldn't he escape this sort of archetypal demise or this whirlpool of wealth and whatever? And I think that's where like the rosebud sled thing comes in. And this is kind of what Claire and I have been talking about and thinking about since is just, I guess just the complexity and depth of your childhood of all these wounds and these unfilled desires. And I know at several points in the film, they talk about like, you know, he just wanted to be loved, you know, and that's where like wealth and power, like we're taught, like, I think those are appropriate ways to describe what he was seeking. But I think it was Leland when he was like in Leland's kind of versions of the stories. I think he mentioned that he really just wanted to be loved, you know, and wealth and power were just kind of the only way he knew how to attain that. You know, that was all he had as a kid. His parents left him. He left his hometown and all he was the rich kid. So it's like, well, how do I get people to love me? How do I, you know, it's like, all right, well, I guess this is it, you know? But alongside that, because like, I mean, he didn't know how to love, you know, I think they used the term like on his own terms. Like that was the only way he knew how, which ends up being the exact opposite of love, you know? He didn't know how to give it. He didn't know how to receive it. But he just knew he wanted it and like was, you know, that's why he built Xanadu. That's why he built this newspaper empire. That's why he ran for office. I guess like in terms of why didn't he escape it? It's because he was like, that's what he was looking for that and had no idea like how to attain it, give it or fulfill that desire.
I'm just kind of picturing like when he was at Xanadu, when Susan left him, like, and I wish I could bring up the picture because I hope I'm not doing this an injustice or speaking inaccurately. But it was like he almost seemed confused when she left him.
Mm.
Like, desperate for sure. But what did he say? I forget his words. Like, how he worded it was like, she kind of smirked and was like, I forget what he said, so I'd have to look at the quote now. But, like, when she left him and she's in her bedroom there, and she kind of she leaves him standing there. He says something like in a desperate attempt to get her back. She almost smirks because it's like his reaction just kind of confirms everything she thinks about him. And then she leaves and he ends up obviously, you know, freaking out and breaking everything. But I feel like there was a moment of just like desperate confusion because he just.
So we see all this different manifestations of darkness, dark behavior on Citizen Kane's part through the film. And it all is sort of balanced through this through line with the idea of Rosebud, like exemplifying this period of innocence where he did feel loved. He felt loved when he was sledding on Rosebud, right?
Correct.
But then that gets forgotten. That just gets literally burned. And the sort of the point that we made on the outline, which I think all of us found a certain wisdom in, but don't hear talked about ever, is that, yeah, even in those darkest people, you know, President Trump, for example, or, you know, even though I think Joe Biden, you know, his counterpart, manifest darkness in different ways, there is still, you know, as Christians, we would say, there is still something to be prayed for them, right? There is still hope to be had.
That, I would say, it hasn't been a word or a concept on our outline, but hearing those two talk, Rosebud, maybe it's like a childhood breakoff point or whatever, but it's actually like the last time that he felt love. Trump's 4-minute review of this movie. I'm sorry.
I pulled up that on YouTube, and there's so, like, I see the one actual thing from him. Another one that's funny is from the Majority Report with Sam Sater. Trump, the title of the video is Trump through 2002 Citizen Kane review, much like the presidency.
Correct. His ending is like, what's the reporter asked him, like, what is the message of Citizen Kane? Like, what should he do? Or like, what would have made it better? And Trump says, you need to get yourself a different woman. You need
yeah, right. We'll have to watch that. But
alluding,
hey, don't we all? Am I right? Am I right, boys?
Taking the most generous take possible, which we're probably not affording this man in 2024. Like, there is a little, like, you know, like, he needs to be loved or to, like, yeah, whatever. Ross, you said it 5 minutes ago, like, he's looking for love in a way to, like, be loved. I don't know. It kind of relates, but it's also
Trump doesn't get it because he's David Foster's Wallace fish in the water. There he's like, water? What's that?
Correct. He at least kind of senses there's water. There's like, there's this substance here I'm swimming in. Is it different than what I think it is or not? Like, it's the first step to acknowledgement of something. Maybe. I don't know.
Yeah, but, I mean, yeah.
Maybe let's just explore a little bit more about Rosebud.
Yeah. I mean, I think that you have, I think one of the most telling, like, for me, like, a switch in the movie, which maybe is a sign why it's a good movie, is how quickly, I don't know if you want to say the director, because he did all of it, but, like, kind of my view changed. So, like, the whole movie I'm watching, and I'm kind of, especially post, when he marries, I think her name was Emily, but, like, after that, I feel like you just see more of the immorality come out of Charles Kane. And he's almost like the quote-unquote bad guy, I feel like. And then it's like a switch that, for at least for me watching the movie, it's like, not that you're rooting against him, but like you definitely have that take that Charles Kane is the bad guy. And then when they start burning the sled, that scene at the very end with the word Rosebud on it, it's like I immediately switched to like a sympathy, or like almost more of a pity, I feel like. But that's, oh man, this guy, you know, he got hurt really bad, and that is why he was, you know, he wasn't just trying to be a jerk. He was searching for something. So I feel like, I think the reason that maybe is maybe the best take-home point from the movie is that when you, kind of like we said, so he's searching for love throughout the whole movie, right? And I think that without that final scene, you don't really see that. You just see a jerk, honestly.
Sure.
But in reality, it's like, nope, like that's a human being that's just, you know, had a really hard childhood and is just searching for love in the only way he knows how. So I don't want to say it's not his fault, because, you know, as an adult, you are responsible for the choices that you make. But in some ways, not his fault, in the sense of that he was set up on this path, you know, towards this wealth and power and these things that aren't going to fulfill him. But I feel like why it's important, I guess important I think that you could kind of take it in the direction of just, and we kind of have joked about Trump a lot, and not that anything we've said is inaccurate, but I think that it's important to remember kind of that same idea that I think my Mike put it in the outline point, somebody else might have as well, but you know, no matter who you're looking at, however bad they may be, that there is something is making them act the way that they are, right? So, you know, Donald Trump was an 8-year-old boy at one point, you know, and his mom and dad probably loved him. And, you know, you can go on and on and on. And I feel like it's important to try to keep in perspective when you're talking about people, you know, that they're a person. And I don't know, I feel like that's why I don't like the late night shows, because I feel like so much of the comedy is just making fun of people, which I understand, you know, it's comedy, blah, blah, blah. But it just seems like that mindset just doesn't seem, it seems like the opposite of, you know, how we should view people, you know, kind of like the Citizen Kane. I feel like I switched from, oh, that guy's a jerk to, you know, almost sympathetic at the end. And I feel like that's maybe a better way to view people or approach people. And it's definitely not how, you know, the modern culture or society operates. You know, the right tears down the left tears down the right. And some people just make fun of both on Facebook. But nobody really seems to view people as, you know, human beings that have these wounds that have caused them to act the way they have. So I don't know. I feel like for me, like the Rosebud thing, just how quickly I switched, I feel like you need that ending to understand Citizen Kane. And I think that was a cool part of the movie, because the whole point of the movie was we want to understand Charles Kane. Like, you had to have, you know, the sled burning to actually get him. And you know, maybe in people's lives, we don't always see the ending per se. So it's harder to do that. But I don't know, I just feel like that kind of point or that idea is maybe the best takeaway from the movie as far as in some way applying it to, you know, our own lives today. To make a super, because we joked about getting canceled, so I'm just going to make a super controversial claim, especially in the United States. Like, I remember after Saddam Hussein got assassinated, people like celebrated, right? I mean, we were all there, right? We remember that. Or no, I'm sorry. Osama bin Laden. I'm sorry. I said Saddam Hussein. Cut that out so I don't sound as dumb. But
Both Middle Eastern, Ross? They're the same to you?
Osama bin Laden.
He,
and I don't
he said
know,
he was going to get canceled for one reason. Now he's getting canceled for totally the other.
I'm just trying to get canceled tonight. Osama bin Laden, I guess assassinated, I don't know. I feel like even that would be a controversial take, right? If that's the right word to describe. But he gets killed. And people, like, celebrated. We got him, right? And I remember one person I know was like, you need to go, like, pray for him right now. And, like, that's such, like, talk about, you know, hot take. Like, I feel like most people would have trouble doing that.
Right.
You know? It's like, well, he's the bad guy. So why would I do that? Because he's bad. You know, and I feel like that's not, and that's the most extreme example I can think of.
I think there's a lot of wisdom that a couple of thoughts on that idea. Don't want to dwell too much on this, but like on the late, I think there is a couple of different categories at some level. You know, it's sort of situational, how well you know them, what the context is. Can sin be mocked, like in a humorous way? I think there's certain latitude for that. And so I would say that, yeah, you know, with a good late night comedian that, yeah, you can do that. Won't go into specifics of that, but just, yeah, it's out of the principle. Right, because, you know, like between us, right, like we might mock each other for, I don't know, being a douche or being thoughtless or something. And then we laugh about it. And then also realize, like, oh, man, like, he was right about that. Yeah, I think that's sort of like the role that can play, too. And then the other thing, yeah, with a praying, yeah, I do 100% agree. Yeah, so, yeah, a person has died. the state of their soul is probably not in a great place. So yeah, he probably does need prayers. You know, in the same way, something that really impressed me with my dad. He was remarking at some point recently of how when he goes on his runs, a lot of the time while he's running, you know, he'll pray for President Trump, right? Prayers in, you know, however, I don't know, there are a million Christian churches in the United States, maybe. And one can sort of imagine, like, how would a particular Christian church respond if, and you could still be, like, very pro-Trump, but have a prayer of something like, man, let's pray that he, and who knows, maybe people have done this, but, like, pray that he repents of his adultery and, you know, commits to speaking truth and not lying. Like, trying to tether these two ideas, Ross, it's like public commentary can just be so much about, like, power rather than truth and genuineness. Even, like, making fun of, like, Saddam Hussein, right, being killed and laughing about it. It's like, for the comedians who made jokes about it, like, that's sort of like a power move, right? It's like, well, I'm a comedian, I'm going to laugh about it. Like, who cares whether it's the right thing to do to mock this guy's death?
This isn't the final bell question, but just because I'm trying to get canceled tonight. Honestly, yeah, to try to make myself and other people uncomfortable a little bit. So, like, what would you do if you see Adolf Hitler in heaven?
I'd ask him when exactly, what exact second, time, date, year did he find Jesus? Like, and I'd want to map that to my historical knowledge of World War II.
Yeah. No, it's a funny point, but I don't know. Like, so I'll tell this. Like, there's a story, and I forget the names of the people, but, like, I feel it seems like, and maybe this is, like, false Christianity, I guess, but, right, we live in a Christian, supposedly Christian world or culture. And it's like, we preach that forgiveness is the ultimate thing. But then it's like, we all pick all these situations like, well, no, I wouldn't forgive that person. Which is, it seems like that would be hard. Yeah, I mean, you can argue, like, objectively if they did these things. But yeah, I mean, what if somebody, and I mean, yeah, I used Adolf Hitler intentionally because that's the worst you can possibly think of, right? But, like, there's a story of a guy that, and I forget their names, but it's like an actual thing. He murdered a girl, like a young girl. And he had, like, his massive conversion when he was in prison. But, like, everybody would be very uncomfortable if he got canonized. You know, I'm not saying he should be. I don't know if he should be or not. But, like, my point is, like, but he's a bad guy. You know, he killed this. So, like, we are very uncomfortable with that. So, like, the easy example is, like, right, C.S. Lewis had a comment, like, you know, he would hope that, so let's see, like, C.S. Lewis fought in World War I, right? So if he met a German in heaven, he would shake his hand and say, like, hey, you know, happy to see you, whatever. Which, I mean, in objectively, if you see someone in heaven, that should be the only response you would have. But, I don't know. I feel like that's the most extreme example, which, right, tonight my theme is trying to get canceled.
Extreme example of...
I'm trying to think of the person who did,
like,
the worst.
And, like, try to tie it back to, like, Citizen Kane.
So, honestly, I was trying to... Yeah, I mean, just as an idea of people are very broken.
Yeah.
Like, they're still people. So, again, at least the most powerful moment for me was the burning of Rosebud and seeing the humanization of his soul.
Yeah,
I feel like this weird burning sled somehow humanized him. So, like, you know, if you meet Donald Trump in heaven, your response shouldn't be to make fun of him. You know, it should be to say nice to see you or whatever. Or, but you can literally put in any person you want, and that should be the response. So I'm not saying that that person will be in heaven. I'm just saying that the idea of salvation and repentance still exists for that person because they're still a person. And just the fact that I feel like it's just even hard to talk about because it's like, I'm not really comfortable with this idea of meeting Adolf. Like, that doesn't make sense to me. If he acted like he did during World War II, I doubt that he repented. But, I mean, I don't know what happened in those last moments or whatnot. So, you know, it's not on me to judge, I guess. But kind of back to the Osama bin Laden comment earlier and such, like, I don't know. As far as what can I take away from Citizen Kane, I feel like this idea of, you know, the humanization of everybody seems to be the best point. And I used very extreme examples, I know, kind of intentionally, but I can't tell if the silence is like, that was a good point, and we're all like, that's a good point, or if it's just it's too late to bring up weird things like that. But
Well, just the other, like, fine point to put on that point, it's like, there's, me and Erica Verdine were talking about this recently. I won't go into the details of this thing from the gym, but it's sort of on this point. It's like, people have a difficult, for whatever reason, well, and we can speculate reasons, but difficult time, I mean, I don't know, duality of thought, if you will. Like, recognizing that, just what we've been talking about. Like, Donald Trump is, I mean, in my regards, not a great person at all. But he is a child of God. He is someone who should be prayed for, et cetera, et cetera. But I think a lot of people would see, like, oh, wait, so you're pro-Donald Trump. It's like, well, no, not at all. But, right, it's just these two ideas. Or another example, not child of God so much, but just duality of thought. It's like, you know, I'm not really for Black Lives, like, giving power to Black Lives Matter. It's just really don't like, oh, so you're racist? Like, no, I'm not racist, right? It's like people have a hard time holding ideas point, like that together for some reason.
We'll point to just for those...
Sorry, I'm just going to say, I'm not pro Adolf Hitler or Osama bin Laden.
I really need to come clean on this one.
I hope that came across clear. I want to get canceled, but I don't want people to hate
the,
me.
The general parable he's referencing is probably Matthew chapter 20. If you'd like to dive in a little further and understand the take Ross just had, that'd be a good chapter to read. Fair? Is that fair?
And if your response to saying anyone heaven is, God, you messed up, you're probably wrong.
And if you want the new edition of the Speech Guy's Bible, that's available at our website.
Includes the Constitution and commentary Lincoln's farewell address at Springfield, which is canon. Feels like Final Bell.
I think so.
I'll be the judge of that. Final Bell.
Ding, 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 ding.
All your strength. All your strength. All your power. All your love.
Hey, Rose. Big thing. One more round. There's no stopping us now. This is our round. Don't stop it now. We're starting. We don't stop. All your strength. All your power, all your love, everything you've got, this is your whole life. Do it now.
And we're back.
We are.
Landon, what do we got?
Final Bell. Okay, Final Bell is that Mr. Charles Foster Kane's last words were Rosebud. This was imprinted on a sled, perhaps as a brand, as a manufacturer of his childhood symbol, emblem, icon of perhaps the last time, as Matt and Ross extrapolated for us, the last time that he felt love or a breaking off point of innocence to brokenness. So the question for us as a Final Bell is, what is our Rosebud. Matt, I believe you may have an interesting qualifier that we may or may not need to hold to.
Are we... So I actually forgot what I said earlier that we thought was good. So are we talking about...
Go ahead.
Are we talking about... Well, I guess the proposal I think we should have is that we should just say it and have no explanation. Whoa. Just to stay in accordance with the movie. Leave a little mystery.
And then we just cut like four words and then end of episode.
I think that would be a really cool way to do it. But I also want to figure out like, is this like the our childhood symbol of innocence, or is this just the word we're going to say when we die?
They're not two different things. Yeah, yeah. Like they're the same thing. Like if we're just cutting to black and like end of scene.
But what if I felt love as an adult? Then it's confusing.
We can explain. I think so you're allowed to say whatever word you want and add an explanation and make it as poetic or as succinct as you'd like.
I'm not going to explain mine.
All right, go first then.
Me?
Oh, if you're not gonna, maybe you should go last if you're not gonna explain it. I'll go first just to kind of get us talking. What comes to mind, and this is just what comes to mind first. My final word would be hedgerow.
The separation of the Johnson estate and wide open farmland.
But I feel like that was like the, and not to try to over like analyze it, but that was, so there's a hedgerow, there's this row of like kind of, and you know, hedgerow row of trees that kind of block my parents' house off from the cornfield behind it. So that was just so much of our childhood, right, was spent playing in it, running around. I mean, it wasn't a huge area, but like pretending like you're whatever you want to be pretending, off on an adventure. So I feel like that to me is the best way to encapsulate like my childhood and playing outside and adventuring with my brother. And I took my kids out there recently. We went to visit my parents and like they wanted to go play in the hedgerow. And Julie said no because she was afraid they were going to get poison ivy. And I kind of regret this now because she had said no, so I should have backed her up. But I told them yes just out of this like no, like. That like was my childhood, so I want them to kind of experience that. So this idea of, you know, play, adventure, innocence, that for me was it. So my final word, if it were to be that, would be hedgerow.
Matt, I think at this point we're probably ending with you, who's just going to say one word and then we cut. So I could probably explain mine. So then it's Mike, you or me?
Mike, are you going to explain? Are you going to explain yours?
I mean, I got something. I don't love it, but we'll run with it. Free Berk. I don't know. I'll be honest. Don't necessarily love my response, but just in the spirit of the question, I guess. I mean, us Freebergians, Freeburg, Illinois. We're a very proud people, a community of 4,000 or so souls. And, growing up there, you know, you had the Catholic school, me, and then the public school. Just a lot of nice little binary divisions of difference. You know, you had the rich kids and everyone else, and... just natural innocence there. Big games of hide and go seek in the woods and bonfires. And, you know, I was thinking this the other day when I was driving down Cemetery Road. Driving down Cemetery Road, that was basically the back road that led out of Freeburg. And it so happened that that was the road that was the more or less the fastest way to get to U of I. So as all through my years, I really enjoyed taking Cemetery Road to Champaign. Mm. As you were leaving town, driving past the city park, down this road that I had run so many miles down, that I had biked for babies down between Freeburg and Champaign. It was sort of just like this major spiritual existential artery of my childhood. And it was fun sort of summoning up that feeling as I was driving down it the other day. So maybe my last words are Cemetery Road. Now that I think about it.
I love that. In Ross's. I'll take one for the team and have two answers. And the obvious one, I think, in all... It's the dying word, the dying breath. And so I think in Christian circles, if you had to like extrapolate some great length of meaning. And I did just hear our church had a speaker, a priest from Scotland come and kind of deliver a long form sermon two nights ago. And his sermon was on basically the power of like the name Jesus and the fact that God came into this world and he didn't come through a methodology, a morality, a geography, a place, any sort of other form of wisdom than like the name of a person. And that is Jesus, and the power of that name has like so many different dimensions. And so hearing this question, dying last breath, I think like in all Christian circles, perhaps the right answer is typically always Jesus. So to proselytize a little, I think perhaps that would be a form of our answer and worthy of all kinds of mystery and glory and salvation. So that would be one for me personally, and more along the lines of our question, the secular nature of this movie analysis. Mine would be Crane Creek. It is a golf course of magical origins that was built when I was in grade school, that I played and worked at through middle school and high school, and that completely shut down in the middle of my college years and is like lost forever to just regrowth of landscape. When I laid my head on my pillow of my childhood home, I could, my eyes directly looking out my window, and in the middle of my window was a gap in the trees of the third hole of a par three, and I could see it. And it's where I worked. It's where I learned the game. It's where I mowed greens and cut trees and sweated for hours in the hot summer August, and is purely my version of Rosebud.
Mm. Nice.
I think
I'm glad I'm not
found...
a...
Let's buy it.
Go ahead.
I found Crane Creek Golf Club. It's got 3.6 stars out of 5.
That's the one. Somebody that's the one. I even think I tried to like commandeer and own that Google webpage. So I've tried to like.
You're trying to control the media, of course.
It. Right. I'm trying. I'm caning that.
You tried to buy the media.
I also have a dream about this course. 12 times a year. It's like my once a month. It's like in the recurring dream category. Like pure straight up playing it again. Everybody I know is there. Definitely my Rosebud.
I'm glad I'm not explaining it because I feel like you guys have really great, I don't know, just enjoyed hearing your explanations. One word and we're signing off. All right.
Trump.
That's right. Oh gosh, that was funny. The word is hammer.
Say it again. What?
Hammer? What?
Hammer.
Hammer?
Think about it. Think about it. But not that much.
Can you tell us and we'll just cut it out? Good. Well, what's our next speech series?
I don't know. I know there's speeches that got someone killed. Seems like an intriguing.
We should just do that because we've talked about it.
I imagine it would be hard to find. Yeah. I can imagine it might be hard to find some speeches.
We could redo Armageddon, and the speech. Yeah, that could
Bruce
definitely.
Bruce Willis died.
You could find some speech in there that got someone killed.
I feel like it'd be easier than we think. I think we're creative enough. We can make it work. It's decided. All right. Next month, I plan on hitting a very solid single right up the middle for speeches that got someone killed.
Well, thanks for drinking.
And thinking.
With us.
Be safe out there. It's been great doing speeches from Oscar-nominated films. Cue the music.
Dead ends come and go. Look toward the horizon. Up ahead you'll find a peace of mind. Relief from the trying. I have burned a bridge. Wrecked in a ditch. Had to ask forgiveness. Dead ends come and go. Look toward the horizon. Oh, there are stories to tell. The times we grew and the times we fell. Oh, I've been afraid some days. But the road will lead us to a better place. The road will lead us to a better place.
To point out and make public the dishonesty, the downright villainy, boss Jim Gettys' political machine, now in complete control of the government. I made no campaign promises, because, until a few weeks ago I had no hope of even being elected. Now I'm something more than hope, and Jim Gettys has something less than a chance. Every straw vote, every independent poll shows I'll be elected. So I can afford to make some promises. The working man, and the slum child know that they can expect my best effort, the best efforts and interests. The working man, they know them, they love me. The decent, the ordinary citizens know that I'll be up for everything. I can do everything in my power to protect the underprivileged. Well, I make no promises. Here's one promise I'll make. Boss Hillary Clinton, lock her up. She knows I'll keep it. My first act will be to appoint a dirty and indict her prosecutor, the boss. That's the speech. It's just a simple, it's a stump speech. It's the main speech within the greatest movie ever. So that's the reason for selection. It is not particularly the content that caught me other than, our series' movies are... ethos is speeches, and this is the intersection of those two things. What'd you think? I email Citizen Kane, watch the movie, here's the three paragraph non-content almost speech. First takes.